Evening, everybody. It is Thursday, August the 16th, and it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Austrian Microeconomics. Our subject for today, building on the lectures of the last several weeks, is profit, loss, and the entrepreneur. We talked a little bit last time about, well, quite a lot last time, about the Austrian approach to production. And some of our time we spent on sort of the physical aspects of production, but most of it we spent on the economic or monetary aspects, right? We spent a good deal of time on the pricing of factors of production. And just toward the end, we got to the analysis of production from the entrepreneur's point of view. So how the entrepreneur calculates costs, money, expenditures on factors, and how the entrepreneur compares costs against revenues in deciding costs against anticipated revenues in deciding what to do ahead of time, and then costs against actual revenues in trying to figure out after the fact whether the decisions that were made were the right ones or not. So what we want to focus on today as sort of an extension of last week's talk is a more narrow consideration of profit and loss, and how this ties into the more general theory of the entrepreneur. So you should see slides in front of you, and I'll go ahead and turn to the first slide. Now, a lot of our time we'll be discussing what Mises calls the evenly rotating economy. Now remember, this is something we talked about at the very beginning of the class, that in causal realist analysis, while we are, of course, focusing on real economic phenomena, real transactions, real prices, real goods and services being exchanged from the point of view of cause and effect, right? That's the realistic and the causal aspect of what we call causal realist theory. Nonetheless, there is a place for what Mises calls imaginary constructs, right? So we can use as sort of tools of reasoning, as mental reasoning tools, we can conceive of different kind of situations that are not realistic, but yet help us to understand by isolating certain factors what's going on in more real situations, right? Robinson Crusoe economics is one example of an imaginary construct, right? I mean, most economic activity does not take place in the context of a Robinson Crusoe situation. It really could be the case that one individual is acting completely isolated from other individuals. But that's a very rare set of circumstances. Nonetheless, we learn a lot about the allocation of resources, including labor and natural resources, across different production processes. We can get a sense of success or failure in terms of achieving endeavors. We can talk about the difference between capital goods and consumer goods, consumption versus investment in a Crusoe situation. But mostly we're interested in explaining more complicated and realistic settings in which you have multiple people interacting with each other. You have trade, either barter trade or monetary trade, and so on. We can learn a lot from studying Robinson Crusoe. There are a few other examples that Rothbard gives in Man, Economy, and State. For example, you can imagine a world of purely specific factors of production. Remember from last time, we talked about factors that have a marginal revenue product that's isolable as compared to factors whose marginal revenue product is not isolable. But one of the requirements for being able to isolate the value of a particular factor is that there is at least some partial substitutability among factors. Right, labor, for example, is a relatively highly substitutable factor. Right, I mean, not everybody is equally good at doing everything, and there are some activities, brain surgery, that I can't perform at all. But yet, I could apply my labor to a pretty wide variety of activities. Some of them, I'd be better at some of these activities than others. Whereas, a copy machine. Right, a copy machine is much more specific. You can use it to make copies, the kind of copier that we have in the office where I work. It's also a scanner. You can use it to, as a copier, as a scanner, as a printer. So it's relatively, it has several uses, You could also use it as a desk. I mean, it's a big thing that sits on a stand. You could use it as a writing desk. You could use it as a door stopper. You could use it as a weapon, I suppose. You could pick it up and try to throw it on top of somebody, and you could crush them. But it's not as usable as labor. It's more specific than labor. You cannot use it, as a vehicle. You cannot use it to produce food and so forth, right? Rothbard says, imagine a world in which every factor of production can be used for one thing and only one, and one thing only, right? We could then derive some theorems about how production would, what would it mean to produce efficiently, how the entrepreneur would attempt to allocate factors to activities, and so on. That isn't the world, that isn't the case in the real world, because most factors of production are not purely specific. But we can imagine a case where it is. Okay, an extremely important imaginary construct in causal realist theory is what Mises calls the evenly rotating economy. It's a kind of long-run equilibrium construct, and Mises describes it in some detail and uses it for only a few very specific purposes. Now, in this evenly rotating economy, you have the following attributes. You do have the passage of time, right? So there is human action in the evenly rotating economy. You have consumers seeking to satisfy their ends according to their preference ranking. You have production, where higher order goods, capital and labor, are transformed into lower order goods that can be consumed. There may be multiple stages of production. The only thing that is different between the ERE and the real world is that there's no uncertainty. There's absolutely no uncertainty about what will happen in the future. In other words, it's like, people are kind of robotic in that they do the same things every day. You know, they wake up and they go to work and they produce the same goods and services each day. Consumers desire to purchase the exact same things every day. So everybody knows, it's like tomorrow will be an exact repeat of today. Some of you old-timers might remember the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. It's a little bit like that. You wake up every day, and every day is exactly like the day that came before. Now, is that realistic? No. I mean, we can sort of conceive of what that would be like, but, there's no situation in real human experience that is like that. And actually, it turns out if you really push on Mises' ERE construct, there are some logical inconsistencies in it, too. What's the point of introducing this construct? Well, remember last time we talked about marginal revenue products and discounted marginal revenue products and how entrepreneurs compute the value of the discounted marginal revenue product and how that establishes the maximum that an entrepreneur is willing to pay for a factor. We had some discussion towards the end of the lecture last time, prompted by some good student questions. The discounted marginal revenue product is the most the entrepreneur would pay for a unit of a factor of production, but wouldn't he like to pay even less, right? What if he could get it on the cheap? And that led to a discussion of, if you have multiple entrepreneurs competing for the use of this factor of production, the price is going to be bid up to its discounted marginal revenue price in equilibrium, right? The plain state of rest purchase price of a factor. But what if entrepreneurs have different expectations about how much consumers will pay for the factor of production in the future, right? And we were talking about bottles of water and ham sandwiches and all kinds of things, right? I think lecture services delivered by Bob Murphy, right? Some entrepreneurs think that the lectures that Bob Murphy produces will sell for, $1,000 on the market. Some entrepreneurs think they'll only sell for $500. So remember, the discounted marginal revenue product of a unit of Bob Murphy's labor is, the amount of additional lecturing that that unit of Bob Murphy's labor can produce times the sales of the lectures that he produces. So even if all entrepreneurs agree on the physical productivity of Bob Murphy's labor, they might disagree on its market value, which won't be until after the lectures are produced and delivered. right? So right now, entrepreneurs bidding for the services of Murphy with different views about how much Murphy's labor is really worth in monetary terms, right? So you're going to have differences of opinion. The entrepreneur who pays the most for Murphy is the one who has the highest expectation about what Murphy's labor will be worth. If it turns out that he's right, he's going to make a profit, right? But if he's wrong, he might earn a loss. So in other words, the only way you get profit and loss is if either entrepreneurs make errors in their estimates about what will happen in the future, or you have different views among different entrepreneurs about what the future will bring. Otherwise, right, if every entrepreneur knew exactly with certainty the dollar value of an increment of Bob Murphy's labor, then they would all have the same willingness to pay for that unit of labor. And, you know, if there's only one, then you might flip a coin to decide who gets it, but everyone would have the same valuation. All entrepreneurs would have the same valuation of that unit of Bob Murphy's labor. And there wouldn't be anything left over, right? The entrepreneur would pay the full DMRP, and so after production has taken place, goods and services have been sold to consumers, monetary receipts come in to the entrepreneur. Well, the entrepreneur has to pay all that out to factors of production, right? I mean, he's reimbursing himself for the money that he's already paid out to factors of production. There's nothing left over, right? There may be an interest component if he had to borrow money from a lender, or if he left the money out of his own personal funds, but there's nothing left over net of costs. The only way you can get profit and loss is if you have uncertainty about what consumers will be willing to pay in the future. So the purpose of the ERE is to distinguish profit, pure entrepreneurial profit, from other kinds of income that might come in to the entrepreneur. Right? So again, if the entrepreneur is paying factors of production out of his own personal funds in advance, and then reimbursing himself out of the proceeds in the future. Remember, he's paying a discount due to time preference. So after his receipts have come in, if he just looks at his financial statements, if the entrepreneur looks at his income statement, right, he has so many dollars of expenditure that went to factors, he has so many dollars of revenue that came in as receipts, you know, there may be some net income, but that net income might, some of it is interest, right? Some of it is the entrepreneur's own implicit wage, right? If the entrepreneur could have hired himself out to somebody else and worked, earned a certain amount of money as a worker, that needs to be deducted from any income that came in the context of running his business. In other words, he's expending some labor services as a manager of his business in addition to the pure entrepreneurial function. In the ERE, there's nothing left. Right, in the ERE, there is positive business income, but all of it is either interest or the entrepreneur's implicit wage as a manager. There's nothing else left over. In the real world, right, there's an interest component to business income. There's a managerial wage component to business income, but there's also pure entrepreneurial profit and loss. The only way to understand what entrepreneurial profit and loss really is to imagine a world in which they don't exist, right? In a world without uncertainty, there's no entrepreneurial profit and loss, though there still could be interest and there still could be an implicit wage. So there's still business income in the ERE, but there's no profit and loss. Therefore, you see the conclusion, the sole origin of profit and loss is uncertainty. It's uncertainty that brings about entrepreneurial profit and loss, not the passage of time, not the skill of the entrepreneur as a manager. Those things do not generate profit or loss. Only uncertainty about the future and the entrepreneur's ability to anticipate the future explains profit and loss. Okay? That's the reason for introducing this particular imaginary construct. There's a question already about comparing the ERE to perfect competition as used in mainstream economics. Let me come back and answer that at the end, but that's a very good question. Okay, so what is the entrepreneurial function? What is the pure function of the entrepreneur? we've already discussed it last week and just now. But here's a nice way to summarize it. It's the deployment of resources in the present in anticipation of uncertain future receipts. Okay? So entrepreneurship involves the possession, control, and deployment of heterogeneous resources, capital, land, and labor, right? And their combination into goods and services to be sold to consumers in the future in anticipation of money, of dollar revenues that come in. Okay? That's what the entrepreneur does. That is the unique function of entrepreneurship. It's this combination and recombination of heterogeneous resources under uncertainty. Two things to notice. Notice that entrepreneurship implies ownership of property, right, of real goods and services. So in addition to the entrepreneur's own labor, there's also stuff, right? There's raw materials, there's machines, there's buildings, there's land. And these things have to be used, have to be employed in particular ways by the entrepreneur. So the entrepreneur is not just kind of an idea man, an arbitrageur who doesn't get his hands dirty in actually taking control of resources and making decisions about them. No, quite the contrary. It's this kind of ultimate responsibility about how property will be used, productive goods and services, how they'll be used, that marks the entrepreneur as distinct from other agents in the economy. Also notice that, you know, a lot of characteristics that we often associate with entrepreneurship, particularly in the sort of, you know, more popular ways we imagine the entrepreneur, I'll come back to some of these later, these are not necessarily part of the pure entrepreneurial function, right? Imagination and creativity and alertness and leadership and so forth, right? I mean, the actual living flesh and blood entrepreneur, the individual agent who exercises the entrepreneurial function in the economy, you know, may also be highly imaginative and very creative and a strong leader and so forth, but does not necessarily need to have those attributes. And likewise, there might be other agents in the economy with a lot of imagination and creativity and so on who do not take possession of capital resources and other resources and combine them in the anticipation of future consumer wants, that and are therefore not entrepreneurs. Okay. So, what is profit? By implication, what is loss? Right. Profit is the residual, the money income that's left over to the business owner after the factors of production have been paid. Right. And it's either if that's a positive number, it's profit. If it's a negative number, it's a loss. Right, so again, in the evenly rotating economy, in other words, in a situation with no uncertainty, the prices of all factors of production would be exactly equal to their discounted marginal revenue products. So there's nothing left over for the entrepreneur, no profit or loss. Again, in the ERE, you'd still have income, right? Laborers would still earn wages because there's work and production in the ERE. Owners of land would still earn rental payments, right? Capitalists would still earn interest from lending, right? So there's the passage of time in the ERE, there's time preference and so on. But there would be no profit and loss because profit and loss can only exist under conditions of uncertainty. A couple of notes about profit in this understanding, right? First of all, you know, we can imagine a kind of you know, subjective psychic notion of profit, right? You know, I went to the movies and I paid $8.25 for the movie ticket and I got some satisfaction out of watching the movie. You know, if I really, really liked the movie, I'd say, wow, I got, you know, way more than $8.25 worth of utility from watching the movie. If I didn't like the movie very much, for example, Heretical Thought, I did not think the new Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises, was all that good. I thought it was highly overrated. I don't think I got $8.25 worth of utility out of watching the new Batman movie. I'd say, man, this is terrible. I got a loss, you know, whatever. But notice, in these cases, the profit and loss are not measured in monetary terms, right? They're purely subjective and personal to me. Now, we could imagine there are certain contexts in which using the terms profit and loss in that sense may make sense, may be useful to us. But in the, you know, from the point of view of the professional commercial entrepreneur, profit and loss are only meaningful if they are measurable, right? So this is why, you know, it's so important for Mises to integrate money into the entire economic system, the system of thought. I mean, if you've studied Mises before, you know that Mises was his first great book, important book that sort of put him on the where he earned his reputation in the German-speaking world as a great economist was his book on money, published in 1912. And that was before he did his great book on socialism and long before he wrote Human Action and so on. Mises was known primarily as a monetary theorist, but his objective was to sort of integrate money into the more general system of economic understanding. So everything for Mises is all about his theory of economic calculation, his theory of profit loss, and theory of bureaucracy and so on, intervention. All has to do with the ability of the entrepreneur to measure things using a common unit of measure, i.e. money, right? A common measuring scheme. Profit and loss only can be measured in a monetary economy, not in a barter economy, right? So Robinson Crusoe cannot calculate his profit and losses the same way that an entrepreneur in a monetary economy can. I cannot calculate my profit and loss from going to the movies the same way that a commercial entrepreneur can operating in a monetary context. Another common mistake is you hear neoclassical economists and practitioners sometimes talk about, you know, profit as if it were a rate. Right? They say, well, you know, in the energy industry, 3% is a good profit rate, and you know, in software and IT, you might be able to get 4% or 5%. Look, profit is an amount, right? It's a dollar amount, a profit or a loss. It's not a rate of return on investment. So there's no such thing in causal realist economics as what they call kind of a normal rate of return or a normal profit. You sometimes hear mainstream economists talk about normal profits in an industry of 2% or 3%, or in certain hypothetical constructs in mainstream economics like the model of perfect competition. You'll hear people say that, well, you know, the normal rate of profit is zero. Anything above zero is abnormal profits or excess profits or monopoly profits. Not at all the case in causal realist understanding. Right? There's no such thing as normal profit because of uncertainty. Right? Every entrepreneurial action under uncertainty will generate either profit or loss. There's nothing normal about it. You know, just breaking even is not any more ordinary or expected or normal than earning a substantial money profit or a substantial money loss. There's no such thing as a normal rate or abnormal profits or excess profits. It just doesn't make any sense. Okay. Let me elaborate just a little bit on uncertainty since we've been talking about uncertainty here. What is uncertainty? Are there different kinds of uncertainty? And those of you who are at Mises University heard me talk a little bit more about this, a little more detail about this in my lecture on uncertainty. And I'll just briefly review that here. The great American economist Frank Knight is famous for distinguishing between what Knight called uncertainty and risk. Comes out of his doctoral dissertation published in 1921 as Risk, Uncertainty, and Profit. Knight uses the following definitions. He says, think of risk as a situation where we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we have a very good idea of what could possibly happen, right? So games of chance, right? I think I mentioned this example before. If you throw a normal, you know, six-sided die, you don't know what number is going to come up, but you know that there are six possible numbers. And if it's an unweighted die, the probability of any one number coming up is 1/6. Roulette might be like this, and there might be other games of chance you don't know what's going to happen, but it's a pretty well-defined problem. In contrast to what Knight called situations of uncertainty where we don't even, we don't know the range of possible outcomes, much less do we have a probability distribution, right? So, I'm going to go into business, selling bottled water or selling Bob Murphy or whatever. If that would that be pimping? I don't know. There's no probability distribution where I can go look up in a statistics textbook. The probability that I will earn $1 million is 0.2. The probability that I will earn $100,000 is 0.3. The probability that I'll just break even is 0.1. Whatever. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it would be completely arbitrary if an entrepreneur were to use that kind of thinking. So Knight says, well, under situations of true uncertainty, you can't use mathematical probability analysis. You can't calculate expected values and expected return. It's just using algebra to know what's sort of the right thing to do and what's the most profitable course of behavior. Should I be in this line of business or not? Instead, the entrepreneur has to use a different, a more intuitive kind of decision making, what Knight called judgment. I'll come back to judgment in just a moment. Another way to elaborate on this distinction is in the language that was used by Mises' younger brother, Richard. So Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian economist, had a younger brother named Richard who was a very famous probability theorist. In fact, Richard is actually much more famous within his field than Ludwig is within his field. Richard von Mises was a professor in Germany who emigrated to the U.S. in the 1920s, I think, and became a famous professor at Harvard teaching statistics and probability theory. And Ludwig von Mises in Human Action uses the terminology and the sort of conceptual apparatus of his younger brother Richard. And the language that the Mises brothers use is not risk and uncertainty, but rather class probability and case probability. By the way, Ludwig does not actually cite his younger brother even while using the same his younger brother's insights. Apparently, the two brothers did not get along very well and were not on speaking terms. David Gordon has a funny story. Richard von Mises was also involved with the Vienna Circle and the philosophers of the Vienna Circle, Rudolf Carnap and people like that. And supposedly when Richard von Mises died earlier than his older brother Ludwig, and when Ludwig von Mises heard the news that his younger brother had died, he said something like, well, he was a logical positivist. That was the degree of warmth that the older Mises felt for the younger. But anyway, you can get a better version of the joke from David Gordon. The Mises brothers meant by class probability, or what Richard in his development of this theory meant by class probability, is a situation where you have where the event in question is very much like a bunch of other events that share its essential features, right? So each event is part of a class of very similar repeatable events, and what constitutes very similar is sort of subjectively defined in the mind of the decision maker. But again, think of games of chance. You could say that, well, how do I know that if I throw a die, the probability that the number 3 will come up is 1/6. Well, Richard von Mises says, you don't have to sort of logically deduce this from the properties of the die. Rather, you could just throw a whole bunch of them, right? You could just keep throwing the die over and over again, hundreds of times, thousands of times, and just write down on a sheet of paper, how many times does the number 1 come up, how many times does the number 2 come up, and so on. Right? And if you do this enough, you'll find that in the limit, the frequency that any one number comes up is 1/6. Right? So this is sometimes called the frequentist approach to probability, where the probability of a given outcome is defined in mathematical terms as the limit on the frequency distribution of all the different outcomes that could come up. Right? So of course you can only do this if you actually can throw the die, repeatedly. So another way to think about this is events characterized by class probability are insurable events, insurable risks, to use Knight's term. Right, so think about, you know, buying insurance on your house, right, fire insurance. So, you know, I own a home and I have a fire insurance policy on it. The insurance company doesn't know what's the likelihood that Peter Klein's house will catch on fire today. But, you know, they have many decades, hundreds of years worth of data, right, on the probability of a lightning strike or, among people who live in a certain area in houses with a particular size in particular neighborhoods, how many people accidentally leave the stove on or are smoking a cigarette in bed and catch their house on fire. Well, we know historically it's about one out of every 10,000 houses with particular attributes in a given day. And they have actuarial tables that they can use to estimate the likelihood that any given house will catch on fire. Right? So without knowing anything more about me, other than where my house is located and how big it is and whether or not I have an alarm system and maybe whether or not I'm a smoker, a few other general attributes, they then just sort of pool me with all of the other homeowners who share the same attributes. And they know that on average, one out of 1,000 of us will have a fire in a certain, we'll make a claim in a certain period of time. So you have to be able to bundle individual events into this class of homeless events, and then you look at the historical frequency with which an outcome happens to any given member of the class. That's to be distinguished from what Mises calls case probability, right? So case probability applies to situations where each event is completely unique. Each event is a unique case. There is no class of repeatable events with which the event in question can be bundled. Okay? Sorry, I lost my train of thought for just a second. Business outcomes, right? I mean, every business is unique. I mean, they're all businesses, right? And they might all be in the tomato industry. But you cannot classify tomato industry entrepreneurship, each occurrence of it, into some general class of entrepreneurs such that the likelihood that anyone will earn a profit is, 13.5%. Okay? So when each event is unique, you cannot use mathematical formulas to estimate the likelihood of outcomes. You have to use what Mises called understanding. And it sounds much better in German, Verstehen, which is a German word that we usually translate in English as understanding, but really has a deeper meaning. It's kind of, deep, fundamental worldview sort of understanding. And that's what the entrepreneur has to use in, when you have situations of case probability. Okay, so in other words, if there were no uncertainty, if all that was relevant was risk and class probability, well then also there would not be entrepreneurial profits and losses on average, right? I mean, some entrepreneurs might get lucky, some might get unlucky, but every entrepreneur ex ante would make the exact same decision. Everybody would calculate the same expected value of the DMRP for every factor. Every entrepreneur would have the same willingness to pay. The only differences might be in, their degree of risk aversion or something like that. You would not get pure entrepreneurial profit and loss if everything were risk or class probability. It's because instead we have uncertainty and case probability, right, that we do have a need for entrepreneurial decision-making. Decision-making that cannot be modeled formally using some kind of, decision rules or equations. Right? Instead, you need entrepreneurial judgment or entrepreneurial understanding. Again, what profit is not? Right? Profit is not the same thing as interest, even though they both show up as dollars on a firm's income statement. Right, so one of the great contributions of Frank Knight and also of Mises in Human Action is, allowing us conceptually to break business income down into these different components. Some of it is interest, some of it is profit, some of it may be the entrepreneur's implicit wage. Right, interest is the reward for foregoing consumption. Profit is the reward for successfully bearing uncertainty. at loss, if you like, is the penalty for unsuccessfully bearing uncertainty. Right? So accounting income, business income, includes both profit and interest, as well as the entrepreneur's implicit wage. Right? So when we talk about profit in the economic sense, right, we say that entrepreneurs earn profit just as workers earn wages and landowners earn rents and capitalists earn profits. We're talking about an abstract economic function, not just a line item in the accounting statements. Okay? By no means is profit any kind of, you know, automatic return to capital. There's some neoclassical theories of production that act as if, okay, you know, here's some capital right here. If I have some capital and I just invest it, then it's going to generate profit, and I can just sit back and relax and watch the profits come in. I was watching one of these shows. Well, my wife made me watch it. My wife likes these. Her favorite channel is the Home and Garden Television Network. I forget the name of the show, and maybe those of you outside the U.S. have similar versions of these shows in your countries. There's all bunch of shows about, you know, people buying a house, buying your house for the first time, renovating a house, flipping houses, building a new kitchen in the house. There's you know, thousands of hours of television every night, it seems like, on these kind of shows. And the one last night was about this couple who had bought a they bought an older house, they were going to renovate the house and then rent it out to renters. And they had gotten stuck trying to renovate the basement, and they had to call in the host of the TV show to do the renovation for them. Anyway, the husband of this couple was saying, you know, the host asked, well, you know, why did you get into this? Why do you want to be a landlord? And he said something like, well, you know, I've worked hard all my life, blah, 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 blah. I'm tired of working all the time. I want my money to work for me. By which he meant he wanted to buy this house and renovate it and earn enough money from tenants paying rent, you know, to cover his mortgage payment on the house and have a little bit left over for him. And he acted like, gosh, if I can just do this, get this basement renovation done, have a nice apartment that I can rent out, then I'm just going to kick back and the money's just going to come in. And, you know, I was sort of screaming at the TV, no, it doesn't work that way. You're forgetting about uncertainty. And made it rather unpleasant for my wife to watch TV. But, you know, it's by no means the case that you can buy a house and just and rent it out and just sit back and wait for the money to come in. I mean, this guy didn't, it's like he thought that it would just be automatic. Of course, you know, you can always get a renter. And the renter will always pay whatever price you need to cover your mortgage payment. And, you know, as the landlord, you'll never have to worry about, you know, the house being flooded or the refrigerator breaking down or the toilet not working. Of course, if you've ever owned property and rented it out, being a landlord is a lot of stress and there's a lot of uncertainty because you've got to make repairs and you've got to deal with nasty tenants and you've got to find tenants and sometimes throw tenants out and deal with a whole host of problems. You know, I want to say, buddy, how much money you're going to make from this little enterprise? You don't know. It's uncertain. Now, if in fact this guy is able to get renters, good renters who are low maintenance and pay the rent on time, and he ends up making a lot more money than it cost him to buy the house, renovate the house, and so forth, well, you know, good on you, buddy. But that's entrepreneurial profit, right? That's the gain from him successfully anticipating how much revenue he would actually come in. You know, if they revisit the same couple 6 months later or 1 year later, the guy might be in tears. You know, or he might be in bankruptcy court or something because he's lost so much money. There's no automatic return to investment that entrepreneurs get. That's not what profit is. And at the same token, right? Remember we talked last time about the example of champagne and the Austrian view that, you know, the prices consumers pay determine the costs to the entrepreneur. In other words, the prices of the factors, not the other way around, as classical economists believed, as Karl Marx believed, right? Some practitioners and even some economists today act as if, well, here, you know, profit, you go out and buy a bunch of stuff that you need to make things, and then just add a markup over your production cost, and that's your profit. I mean, again, we saw this with the champagne example. That can't be the case because, you know, I could spend a lot of money to hire Bob Murphy, and he produces lectures, and maybe his lectures stink. Hypothetical, right? And his lectures stink, and nobody will pay for them. Well, I can mark up the price all I want. I'm not going to get any revenues, right? I'm not going to have any profit. I'm only going to have profit if consumers want to buy the thing that I'm offering. I can mark up the price all I want. It doesn't guarantee I'm going to get any revenues. Okay. So the really bad Bob Murphy lectures, I guess that would be an imaginary construction too, because we know how wonderful his lectures are. And by the way, I know one of you is leaking to Bob Murphy all of my bad Bob Murphy jokes because he confronted me on it last week. I don't know who the spy is, but I'm going to find you and I'm gonna rub you out. A few comments about resources. I've said this already, but it's worth making it more explicit and, you know, putting in a plug for the Austrian school here, right? One of the great contributions that the Austrian tradition makes to production theory is, you know, it's very elaborate discussion of resources, the characteristics of capital resources, that they're heterogeneous, right? That, you know, the copy machine I described earlier is not equal to a mobile phone or a other kind of machine or a piece of farmland or a worker or whatever, right? Resources are heterogeneous, and the characteristics of resources are perceived subjectively by entrepreneurs, right? So one thing another detail we can add to our story, in the examples I gave before with profit and loss, when, right, we were acting as if, well, okay, I mean, everybody knows that this capital machine can produce this output. The only uncertainty, the only differences among entrepreneurs are, well, how much will you be able to sell the output for? In the market for consumer goods. But look, there are also maybe differences of opinion in what resources will actually work to produce goods and services. You know, what is a valuable resource? What are the attributes of this resource? To what degree is it complementary with other kinds of resources? You know, when we talked about last week, you know, calculating the marginal physical product and then later the marginal revenue product, inputs. I mean, that is also subjectively perceived by the entrepreneur. You know, lots of great examples through history. You know, oil is an obvious example. You know, petroleum. That it isn't the physical characteristics of petroleum that make it a valuable resource that has a very high discount and marginal revenue prospect. It's, you know, the ability of human beings to perceive that oil, that petroleum can be refined into gasoline and you know, kerosene and so on, and used for, you know, to drive cars and fly planes and all that. You know, before people had the knowledge that of how to refine petroleum. I mean, there was always petroleum in the ground, and sometimes it oozed up into the people's land. And you know, before the middle of the 19th century, early 19th century, if you had petroleum on your land, well, that made your land worthless, right? Petroleum was just sticky black goo, by far, that nobody wanted. You couldn't give that land away. It was only after people figured out that you could take that stuff and make it into kerosene and gasoline and jet fuel that it became a valuable resource. So the heterogeneity of resources, the degree to which they're substitutable across production processes, the specific attributes that a given resource has, how useful it is in producing particular contributors, those are, all of that is subjectively perceived by entrepreneurs. A current quote from the 20th century Austrian economist Ludwig Luckmann wrote as follows. That's from Luckmann's 1956 book, Capital and Its Structure, which is a great book in production theory. Luckmann says, we are living in a world of unexpected change. Hence, capital combinations will be ever-changing, will be dissolved and reformed. In this activity, we find the real function of the entrepreneur. Right? So we're living in a world of unexpected change, i.e. uncertainty as opposed to risk, case probability as opposed to class probability. Hence the capital combinations that entrepreneurs use in production will be forever changing, right? Entrepreneurs are frequently dissolving and then recombining resources in different ways. In this activity, the combination and dissolving and recombination of heterogeneous, subjectively perceived resources under conditions of uncertainty, that is the real function of the entrepreneur. And if you've looked at my book that came out earlier this year with Nicolas Foss called Organizing Entrepreneurial Judgment, we make the Slotman quote kind of the leitmotif, right, of our entire book. To reiterate a point made earlier, because resources are heterogeneous, you know, profits and losses can only be calculated in money terms. But you can also say that, you know, the entrepreneur's capital stock you can only put a number on that in a monetary economy. Otherwise, you just have, you know, one copy machine plus two pieces of land plus this machine plus Bob Murphy plus this plus that. You wouldn't have a number that you could to know, you know, whether your capital stock is increasing in value or decreasing in value, is it bigger or smaller than my competitor's capital stock, you wouldn't be able to answer those questions outside a monetary context. Okay. So, just to sort of recap, the entrepreneur function in practice is closely tied to the capitalist function, right? And that you can think of the firm as the sort of intersection of the capitalist and the entrepreneur function. And if you like the idea of bringing the capitalist and the entrepreneur together, you might enjoy this wonderful book published in 2010 called Capitalist and the Entrepreneur, essays on organizations and markets. And I can guarantee that if you buy this book, you will get your money's worth. And the reason I know that is because you can download the book for a price of zero at Mises.org. I guarantee it will be worth more than what you pay. You can also buy a paper version for, I think, $12 or $15. And that I can't issue the guarantee on a paper version. You know, what I do in the book is try to bring together these Austrian insights, heterogeneous resources, the time structure of production, Mises' concept of economic calculation, and this idea that competition among entrepreneurs sort of selects the better from the worse entrepreneurs. Bringing all those insights together gives us a nice comprehensive integrated theory of the business firm. Okay? Enough about me. As Lily Tomlin once said, I think it was Lily Tomlin, enough about me, let's talk about you. What do you think of me? Well, you're all here, so you must think a lot of me. Just an aside on profit and loss, you know, because in popular culture, and of course in Hollywood and among government officials, the profit is often seen as something negative. Right? You know, greedy businessmen earn profits, and that somehow takes away from consumers, you know, workers, and other people, and at least in English, to call somebody a profiteer is a real insult. You know, it's like a nasty, sociopathic person who doesn't care about anybody else but just profits. And profits are, it's bad to want profits. Well, of course, from a purely scientific point of view, that's all completely irrelevant. I mean, even from a more sort of social, political, economy point of view, these kinds of criticisms completely misunderstand what profit is. If you think that profit is something that rich guys get from just sitting around and investing their capital, well, then you might not think very highly of it. But of course, that isn't what profit is, not that at all, right? Profit is the reward for bearing uncertainty. So profits and losses, right, provide feedback for entrepreneurs in their short and long run planning, right? So how does the entrepreneur ever know if his decisions were correct or incorrect? Right, when we talk about a market economy being this sort of marvelous mechanism for allocating productive resources to their highest value uses, maximizing the well-being of society in, in the only sort of way that we can make that statement in a scientific sense. What Mises calls consumer sovereignty. The only way that we can ever know that consumer consumer sovereignty obtained is because of this feedback mechanism that is provided through the profit and loss system. Right? I mean, just to give you one concrete example, talk about subsidies and bailouts. Most of you know about the situation in the U.S. In 2008, 9, 10, when the Obama administration bailed out General Motors. General Motors, the largest U.S. automaker, of course, is bankrupt, and through outright cash transfers and subsidized loans, and General Motors was rescued from bankruptcy. And the whole lot of issues associated with that, the way it was done, and violation of bankruptcy law, a lot of long-term consequences, and so on. But a very simple way to think about the effect of a bailout, right, is that it is it's in denial of consumer sovereignty, right? I mean, the fact that General Motors was bankrupt, that's the market's way of communicating that, you know, General Motors, the entrepreneurs in charge of General Motors were doing a bad job, right? They were not good entrepreneurs. General Motors was not using heterogeneous, subjectively perceived capital resources in ways that were satisfying consumer wants. Consumers did not want to buy a GM product at the prices that at prices were not willing to pay enough so that General Motors could earn profits. So the losses were the market's way of saying those resources would be better employed elsewhere in the economy, right? So the economically efficient course of action, the social welfare maximizing course of action in a case like that, is to let the company go bankrupt and free up those resources, land, labor, and capital, for other entrepreneurs to use in other productive activities, right? Now, of course, when we say that, that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be some harm that is visited on particular, obviously, entrepreneurs, but the stockholders and bondholders of GM, GM workers, and of course nobody likes to lose their job and be told, well, you gotta find another job somewhere else. But that's just part of the market process of reallocating resources from one activity to another. Right? I mean, by failing at General Motors, the government is saying, well, regardless of what consumers want, then profits and losses, if profits and losses were determined by the state, by political patronage or something like that, then we simply have no idea whether capital, land, and labor is being used in ways that satisfy consumer wishes or completely violate consumer wishes. We couldn't say anything about economic efficiency. And by the way, there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal yesterday by Robert Barrow, famous Harvard economist, not an economist, not a causal realist economist, but a good neoclassical economist who made exactly the point that I just made against the GM bailouts. I think he did it pretty well. This whole idea of a selection process, right? Sorry, there should be a bullet right here. profit and loss establishes this kind of selection process where, you know, the market is sort of, you know, rewarding and penalizing particular entrepreneurs. Right? So every entrepreneur can make mistakes, right? But if an entrepreneur systematically, you know, overpays for factors of production, meaning pays more than what the DMRP will eventually be revealed to be once production is done and consumer valuations are revealed and so on. An entrepreneur like that, you know, cannot be an entrepreneur for long. Right? I mean, if you systematically get it wrong, if you systematically earn losses, that's the market's way of telling you you ought to be in another line of work other than entrepreneurship. And eventually, you're going to run out of capital, and no one will give you a loan, and you won't be able to be an entrepreneur. Right, those who are systematically good at anticipating consumer desires, who are systematically able to acquire factors of production at prices below their eventual DMRPs, will prosper. They'll make a lot of money, and they'll be on the cover of Forbes. They'll be able to acquire lots of capital, and they'll become Steve Jobs or, you know, whatever. If we did not allow the profit and loss mechanism to work, we're not allowing consumers to express their preferences for particular entrepreneurs over others, and thus we don't have any kind of economic efficiency. Okay. Now, of course, you know, we've been talking about, you know, sort of the pure entrepreneurial function in the economy and the role that entrepreneurship plays, of course, all critically important. However, you know, if we look kind of empirically, historically, at what goes on in the real economy, we notice that, you know, those who most successfully exercise the entrepreneurial function tend to have particular personality characteristics. I mean, that isn't true sort of a priori from a praxeological point of view, but empirically, as a historical contingency, there are particular individuals who happen to be really good at exercising the entrepreneurial function. Now, as Mises notes in Human Action, we typically use the same word, entrepreneur, to describe both the pure entrepreneurial function of economic theory, what we've been talking about, and this sort of, you know, sort of set of personality traits. Mises says, economics also calls entrepreneurs those who are especially eager to profit from adjusting production to the expected changes in condition. Right? So those who are especially eager to profit, those who have more initiative, more venturesomeness, and a quicker eye than the crowd, the pushing and promoting pioneers of economic improvement. Right? And Mises suggests that we use another word for people like this. He suggests that we call them promoters. So in Human Action, Mises uses the term entrepreneur to describe the pure entrepreneurial function, but he uses the term promoter to describe those individuals who tend to be pretty good at it, right? You know, what do we mean by the promoter? What are some of these characteristics? Well, I mean, these are people who, you know, they own and invest a lot of financial capital or physical capital. They are particularly alert to profit opportunities, if we want to use that language, Israel Kirzner's language. You know, they're creative, they have good leadership skills. You know, we mean people like Steve Jobs, and you know, you can think of your favorite sort of entrepreneurs of the present day or of, you know, in the past, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates, or if you want to go back to the Industrial Revolution, you know, Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller and Henry Ford and so on. But these are people who are not only exercising the entrepreneurial function of theory, they're just also really creative guys, really driven, and gals, hardworking, they attract other people, they may be good leaders in kind of the warm and fuzzy sense of Steve Jobs. I've been reading the Walter Isaacson book, a biography of Jobs. Apparently, Jobs was a very effective leader in a different way. He was also kind of a jerk, right, who yelled at people and cut people down all the time. Was very nasty to his coworkers, but he inspired them through his genius. That's another kind of leadership. But the point I'm making is that this notion of the promoter, you can't really define the promoter with praxeological certainty. It's a kind of a looser, historically contingent concept. If you like Max Weber's terminology, you could say the promoter is an ideal type. Right? So we kind of know what it is, but we can't necessarily articulate it ahead of time. You kind of know one when you see one. Mises' suggestion that we use a different word for the ideal type, promoter, than the pure entrepreneur didn't catch on, right? So, unfortunately, even now, most people use the word entrepreneur in both of these senses, even though they're pretty distinct. If we have time at the end of the lecture today, I'll suggest another set of potential terms that might be helpful to us here. A word about entrepreneurs and managers. But if the entrepreneur is coordinating a production process that, is complex and takes a significant period of time, and it employs a lot of other people, it involves a large labor force, right? I mean, the entrepreneur is not going to coordinate and direct everything him or herself, right? Typically, the entrepreneur will delegate some decision authority to other people in the firm and the organization. Middle managers or production managers or whatever. I mean, if we're talking about a large corporation, right, the owners of the corporation who are ultimately responsible for the deployment of heterogeneous resources are, shareholders. Right? And the shareholders don't exercise a lot of day-to-day supervision of what's going on. They delegate most of that to the top management team, to the CEO, who is also an employee, who is an employee of the company. And then the CEO might further delegate to others. In one of the chapters of my Capitalist and Entrepreneur, my 2010 book, Capitalist and Entrepreneur, and also in the my newer book, Organizing Entrepreneurial Judgment, I use the terminology of original judgment and derived judgment. The idea is that the entrepreneurial function, organizing resources under uncertainty, what Frank Knight called judgment, but that can only be exercised by resource owners. But resource owners can delegate kind of day-to-day decision authority to other people, to subordinates, and ask those subordinates to act as if they were the owners. So I call those proxy entrepreneurs, and what they possess is not original judgment, but derived judgment, meaning judgment rights that are derived from the judgment that's possessed by the owners. right? So notice that, you know, even, let's say that I, you know, I own a small enterprise, but I leave it in the hands of a manager, and then I go spend most of my time at the beach, like the guy I saw on TV the other day, and I let the manager do most of the work. Well, I mean, you might say, isn't the manager the one who has to try to figure out what consumers will pay and decide which resources to use and so on? I mean, that's true, but if I'm the owner of those resources, then I possess kind of a higher level of authority over the manager. So even though I have chosen to delegate to the manager most of the day-to-day decision authority, the fact that that was my choice, right, that I could decide to take those decision rights back if I wanted to, the fact that I had to hire the manager and I could fire the manager, right, means that I hold some ultimate, I hold the ultimate decision rights above the manager. Even if I choose not to exercise them every day, I still can, right? And I cannot delegate my ultimate decision authority to the manager. I can only delegate responsibility for, you know, particular activities that we write down in our contract or whatever. So the only way to exercise original judgment is to be a resource owner. The only way to get rid of original judgment is to sell the assets and no longer be a resource owner. Right? So the managers, no matter how much they may actually do on a day-to-day basis, are only exercising that those aspects of judgment that have been delegated to them by the owner. Right? So the manager, even if he acts, you know, if he seems like a promoter in Mises' terminology, if he isn't a resource owner, then he really isn't an entrepreneur. He's what I call a proxy entrepreneur. He's kind of acting like an entrepreneur, even though his, the resource owner above him is actually the pure entrepreneur of economic theory. The reason for bringing up this distinction is that a lot of the problems in organizational design, right, how do you set up a large enterprise? How much should you delegate authority to managers and which managers? And how should managers be and workers be evaluated and compensated and so on? You know, human resource management, setting up incentive schemes, all aspects of organizational design. You can think of these as sort of the art of managing derived judgment. How do you delegate judgment rights throughout the organization? How much should you delegate? How do you monitor to make sure that the subordinates are doing the things that you would want them to do? Are they really acting like entrepreneurs, or are they using their authority to act in ways that may benefit them at the expense of the owners and others within the organization? I suggested earlier that different scholars use, you know, the language of entrepreneurship in different ways. It turns out that, you know, the way I have described the entrepreneurial function in my lecture tonight is, you know, that's the way I interpret Mises and the other causal realist economists from Menger to von Bavert, Fetter and Wicksteed and so on, through Rothbard and Lockman and other economists who have worked this out. This idea that entrepreneurship is the assembly and deployment of heterogeneous resources under uncertainty, that's the way I read Mises and Misesians as describing entrepreneurship. But there are other economists, including economists of the Austrian school, who have defined the entrepreneurial function in different ways. Right? So Israel Kirzner, a very prominent member of the Austrian school, recently retired from New York University, uses a different kind of language. He describes entrepreneurship as alertness to opportunities in the environment. So, you know, this alertness is the idea that, well, the iPad, for example, we can look back at the iPad ex post and say, well, you know, the first iPad, however many years ago it was, you know, let's say it sold for $800. I think the high-end iPads sold for about $800 when they came out. That was more than it cost Steve Jobs to purchase all the factories and transform the silicon and the plastic and the metal and, you know, so forth, glass, to transform into iPads. And, you know, Apple made a ton of money selling iPads at the beginning. You know, sort of, you might look back to that and say, well, wow, that was just sort of a, you know, that was an opportunity just waiting for somebody to figure it out. If Steve Jobs hadn't figured out the tablet market, somebody else would have. There's all that money that consumers are willing to pay for tablets in excess of how much it costs to get the materials is hanging out there waiting for the first person to come along and figure it out. Again, that kind of makes sense ex post. It's harder to make sense of that ex ante, right? So what Kirzner means by the entrepreneur is sort of Mises promoter, but without any capital, right? Kirzner's entrepreneur does not own resources, but is simply alert to arbitrage opportunities, spatial arbitrage, or in the case of the iPad, intertemporal arbitrage, and is able to buy low and sell high in a way that makes a profit, even without having any money of his or her own. So Kirzner does not emphasize uncertainty in his treatment. And he says, yeah, well, there may be uncertainty, but entrepreneurship is about the discovery of profitable opportunities in despite uncertainty, right? He uses the language of piercing the fog of uncertainty. So entrepreneurship is about profit. It's not about loss. Right? Why? It's because Kirzner really isn't that interested in profit and loss per se. He's interested in equilibration. So Kirzner is saying, look, you know, if you think of spatial arbitrage, you know, if the market is in disequilibrium, meaning that you know, selling prices, you know, there are sellers who would be willing to sell at a lower price than the going price. You know, somebody who figures this out can go in and offer to sell the good to consumers at a price lower than the prevailing price and make some money, right? So if the market is in disequilibrium, that means there are opportunities to earn profit from either lowering the price or raising the price, and people will tend to figure this out and will, you know, seize and grasp those profit opportunities, thus bringing the market into equilibrium. Right, so making profit over time, like with the iPad, that's like an example of intertemporal arbitrage. But the disequilibrium is the fact that you could buy the inputs for the iPad in, you know, 2005 and transform them into an iPad by 2006 and sell it for more than what you paid for the inputs, including, you know, including interest. Kirzner is trying to explain why markets kind of equilibrate, and, you know, if markets are in disequilibrium, either across space or over time, then that represents money that could be made by arbitraging those differences away. And people tend to do that, and therefore profit opportunities tend to be recognized and grasped, and they go away. Right? In the process of equilibration, in the process of making those arbitrage profits, prices are brought into their equilibrium values, and profits and losses disappear. So Kirzner is invoking the entrepreneur kind of on the side as, you know, that which entrepreneurship is that which causes markets to equilibrate. Joseph Schumpeter, another famous economist, who's sort of Austrian by birth and by training, but not really a member of the Austrian school, more of a neoclassical economist, characterized entrepreneurship as innovation, right? The introduction of new stuff, new products, new processes, new markets. So Schumpeter was taking Valrasian general equilibrium theory, neoclassical mainstream general equilibrium theory, and saying, you know, what if you add sort of innovation as something outside the model, right? So the market is in equilibrium, but there's a new invention, a new discovery, a new way of producing stuff, a new market that you can sell stuff to, which kind of perturbs the existing equilibrium and generates some profit for the innovator. Right, so whereas Kirzner's entrepreneur is an equilibrating force, Schumpeter's entrepreneur is a disequilibrating force. You might have heard the famous Schumpeter's famous term, creative destruction. Schumpeter described capitalism as a process of creative destruction, meaning you know, continually, you know, the old established order of production is continually sort of swept aside by innovation. You know, old firms go bankrupt, new firms arise, old industries die, replaced by newer industries, certain firms rise and fall, and so on. That's the process that takes place through time, through the creative force of the entrepreneur innovator. Right? So for Kirzner, entrepreneurship is about alertness to opportunities. For Schumpeter, entrepreneurship is about innovation. But for Mises and most of the causal realist tradition, entrepreneurship is more like what Frank Knight described as judgmental decision making under uncertainty. Judgment meaning this way that entrepreneurs evaluate the future in cases of uncertainty or case probability. Now, if you look in the mainstream entrepreneurship literature and some of the practitioner literature, you get even more different concepts of entrepreneurship. Right? Kirzner, Schumpeter, Knight, Mises, all of these guys are talking about entrepreneurship as an economic function. But if you look at the practitioner literature and some of the mainstream academic literature, there's also what I call occupational and structural concepts of entrepreneurship. What I mean by occupational is discussions that define the entrepreneur as a person who works for himself. Right? So an entrepreneur is a self-employed person, and entrepreneurship is the act of being self-employed. Right? So if you work for a company, you're not an entrepreneur. If you work for yourself, you're an entrepreneur. The unit of analysis is the individual person, and entrepreneurship is defined by employment status. So I don't know how it is in all of your countries, but in the U.S., sometimes you get, like a census form to fill in, and what's your name, and what's your date of birth, what's your occupation, truck driver, lawyer, doctor, professor, entrepreneur, homemaker. Right? So entrepreneur is just another employment category. It means you work for yourself. There's a lot of literature among economists, labor economists, trying to predict whether a given individual will go into occupation A or occupation B. Well, there's a lot of studies like that on entrepreneurship that just define entrepreneurship as self-employment, try to predict who's going to become self-employed, who's going to go work for a big company based on age and income and education and gender and family history and who knows what else, maybe based on your personality tests. So some of you may have seen these tests. Are you an entrepreneur? Do you have the entrepreneurial personality? Take this test to find out. Basically, what they mean by entrepreneur is, will you be self-employed? Are you going to quit working for a big company and start your own business and work for yourself? That's what they mean by entrepreneur. There are other studies that take the unit of analysis to be the firm, right, and say that entrepreneurship is startup companies and small companies and high-tech companies and companies with a lot of patents and this sort of thing. There's a lot of literature on industry structure and industry evolution that defines entrepreneurship in the structural sense, a kind of firm or a kind of industry. Now look, it's certainly the case that self-employed people, people who start companies, people who work in highly innovative companies, that they do exercise the functions of alertness and innovation and judgment and so on. The entrepreneurial function is exercised there, but just not exclusively there. Right? I mean, there's not really an obvious relationship between these notions that entrepreneurship is an occupation, a job category, and the notions that entrepreneurship is a kind of firm or a kind of industry, and the more general economic functional analyses that we've been discussing up till now, the assembly of heterogeneous resources under uncertainty. I mean, pure economic entrepreneurship is exercised by self-employed people, but it can be exercised by employed people too, people who work for a big company and own some stock. It can take place in small firms. It can also take place in big firms. It can take place in new, young, high-growth tech firms, but also in more mature, slower-growing, old economy firms. So notice that in our course, we're discussing entrepreneurship as an economic function, not as a job category, not as a personality type, not as a kind of firm or a kind of industry. Okay, well, we need to stop. We started our lecture about 5 minutes late, or maybe it was 10 minutes late because of technical difficulties, so we can run a little bit over our allotted time, but I do pretty much want to stop here. I do have some slides on the theory of the firm that I skipped last week, but just to be a consistent lecturer, I'm also going to skip them this week. Actually, I'm going to go back to, as a good slide to sort of park upon. as we have our discussion. I'll stop here because I like the picture on the slide. So anyway, that concludes the formal lecture part. Let me go back and look at the Q&A thread. Somebody had asked, Kendrick asked early on in the lecture about perfect competition. So look, neoclassical economics also uses imaginary constructs, but they're used in a very different way, right? So you can think of perfect competition or perfectly competitive general equilibrium also being an imaginary construct. But the way causal realist economists use imaginary constructs is purely by way of contrast, right, to say, well, you know, if we were in the ERE, there wouldn't be any profit and loss. Therefore, that tells me that profit and loss, you know, is solely due to uncertainty and not due to time preference. Okay, but I don't use the ERE to evaluate a market. I don't say, well, you know, is the steel industry closer to the ERE than the tomato industry? It doesn't make any sense to use the imaginary construct that way. Likewise with, you know, Crusoe economics and Rothbard's world of purely factors and other imaginary constructs. Neoclassical economists use imaginary constructs very differently. Right? They say, under perfect competition, resource allocation is perfectly efficient, Pareto optimal, blah, 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 blah. Therefore, we should evaluate real-world markets by how close they are to that. Right, so it would be nice if real markets were perfectly competitive or close to perfect competition. So, for example, in the neoclassical concept of perfect competition, then you have lots and lots and lots of very, very small firms. Therefore, if you see a market in the real world that only has three firms in it, well, that's very far from perfect competition. Therefore, the government should intervene by breaking up those three firms into six firms or 60 firms. There should be some policies that encourage there to be more small firms, more firms, smaller firms, more entry of firms. Therefore, you get more rigorous, quote unquote, competition. And therefore, it'll be more like perfect competition. So neoclassical economists use imaginary constructs as ways to benchmark real markets. Causal realist economists don't use imaginary constructs in that way at all. Hope that makes sense, Kendrick. Question about profit. Let's see. Is profit simply a cash flow that is discounted back to a present value or return based on this risk beta? No, I mean, profit is not that, right, in the way that we're discussing it here, right? So there is a temporal aspect of profit, right, because production takes time. But look, you know, profit is not a flow that at the time that a decision is made, you can sort of collapse back into a current number, right? I mean, you know, in accounting terms, profit simply is a per period amount, right? It's not a lump, it's not a present discounted value, it's a per period flow, right? So in those of you who are into accounting, right, profit is on the income statement, profit is not on the balance sheet, okay? So, you know, profit is simply total revenues minus total costs. Right, that's accounting profit, then we subtract out the interest component and the entrepreneur's implicit wage, if applicable, to get the pure entrepreneurial profit piece of that. Right? But profit is a flow per period of time. It's not a stock. It's not a present discounted value of expected future earnings. Okay. So questions about Kirzner's alertness. this, Mark says, Kirzner emphasizes entrepreneurial alertness, yes. An entrepreneur can only anticipate future prices successfully if he's alert to environmental conditions. So then, am I not saying the same thing as Kirzner? Well, let me answer it this way. I mean, the way you put it, Mark, you're sort of, I mean, it sounds like you're describing the same thing that I've been describing, but just using the language of alertness. In other words, you could say that entrepreneur who is successful, right, or entrepreneurs are only successful if they have knowledge of future conditions that will allow them to earn a profit. The problem is, right, to be alert to something, word Kirzner uses, and a lot of some other entrepreneurship scholars uses the word opportunity, right? That the entrepreneur should be alert to a profit opportunity, or the entrepreneur discovers a profit opportunity. The problem with that language, with that metaphor, in my view, is that it acts as if the profit opportunity exists ex ante. Right? So what entrepreneurs are aware of or alert to, in my conception, is not a profit opportunity that actually exists. It's just their kind of their vision of what the future might be like. Right? I mean, they're alert to the fact that they think you can sell the product for X amount of dollars, and that will more than exceed what it will require for them to acquire the to purchase the factors. But that doesn't exist until, you know, that opportunity doesn't exist until you actually buy the stuff and produce, and then you find out later whether you were right or wrong, right? So think about an entrepreneur who earns a loss, a money loss, right? You were wrong. You were alert to this idea that you could sell Bob Murphy's lectures for $10,000 a piece, but in fact nobody will pay more than $50 for them. And you way overpaid, and you know, you realize that's supposed to pay Murphy way more than what he's actually worth on the margin, so you have a loss. You paid Murphy and you didn't get all the money back, you've lost money. Your capital earned, you know, capital account has gone down, whatever. Bank accounts depleted, you're bankrupt. What would you then say you were alert to? I mean, you want to say, well, did you discover a loss? That doesn't make sense. You were alert to something that turned out to be wrong? Okay, fine. But then the word alert doesn't seem to make sense to me. I would just say the entrepreneur perceived or imagined that he could earn X dollars of revenue. It turns out he was wrong. He only earned Y dollars of revenue. He made a loss. Or it turned out he was right, he did earn X dollars. Or he was wrong, he earned even more than X dollars and earned a big loss. But I think the whole language of opportunities and being alert to opportunities and discovering opportunities or even creating opportunities, I think is a little bit misleading and potentially confusing, because it makes it sound like opportunities are things that exist. But opportunities only exist in the mind of the entrepreneur ex ante, right? Hope that makes sense, Mark. Let's see. Question about efficient market theory. So Kendrick, I don't know if I'm getting at what you're asking. I mean, efficient markets theory is this idea that in equity markets, for example, that if all decision makers have access to the same information, then everybody would come to the same conclusion about how much profit a given enterprise is going to yield, and then the prices at which the equities trade in the public equity market would reflect all of the available information about that particular entrepreneur and that particular production process and so on. I mean, no, I think what we're